This and other podcasts are available on the Gun Rights Radio Network, gunrightsradio.com. Podcasting freedom.
I'm hiding in Honduras. I'm a desperate man. Send lawyers, guns, and money. This shit has hit the fan.
Hi, folks. Bob Main here. Why do I carry a gun? Because I can't carry a cop. Welcome to episode number 269 of your weekly Handgun World podcast. This is a practically useful show done by a practical guy because I'm just an everyday guy, like a lot of you that are probably listening to this podcast. As you know, my background doesn't come from law enforcement or doesn't come from military work. I wasn't a gunsmith in a former life or anything like that. I'm just a sales guy. You know, for 29 years, I've been in sales and marketing making a living. And one day I finally decided to take my self-defense seriously. I decided to buy a gun and start competing with it and carry it with me all the time for self-defense, and that's what I do now. So I do the best I can to bring you quality shows that you can learn from. If the sound quality is a little bit different for the introduction here, that is because I don't have my normal recording equipment with me. I got a load of stuff here in the Handgun World mobile studio. Unfortunately, I got a friend of mine who is going through a divorce. It's a tough situation. So this afternoon I helped him load up his vehicle and mine to take a bunch of stuff out to the new place that he lives in. So I got a little bit of free time here because we have about a 30-minute drive ahead. So this episode is basically a homicide detective interview. I got a chance to interview Mr. Jess Caron in Lubbock, Texas. He's a homicide detective in Lubbock, Texas. So he's active law enforcement investigating homicides. He was also a regular cop before that. We'll talk more about that in the interview, but I think it's really neat how he talks about, first of all, the importance of concealed carry. He talks about what you can expect to be questioned about, or he spends a little bit of time, you know, what's the process after you have to fire your gun. That's what I thought was one of the most interesting parts of the interview, where we talked about what is it that you as a civilian can expect to happen to you. And, you know, you're going to talk to a detective, you're going to talk to a homicide investigator, you're going to talk to somebody like that at your local law enforcement. So, and Jess is one of those. He's one of those that does that every day. So, here we go. Jess Caron from Lubbock, Texas. Well, my special guest for this week is Jess Caron from Lubbock, Texas. Jess, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I appreciate you coming on. You know, one of the reasons that I wanted to bring you on the show this week, we're going to talk about a class you have coming up. But before we do that, you're a detective, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
You're a homicide investigator.
That's correct.
I've never interviewed anybody with your experience on this show before. So when you offered it, I jumped right on it because you're going to give us some ideas on a detective's perspective on civilian gunfighting.
Yes, sir. I hope to anyways.
Yeah. Well, gosh, your experience. How long have you been in this kind of work?
I've been a police officer for a little over 6 years, and then I've actually been investigations for about a year and a half.
Okay. And I know that you're also an aspiring instructor. We're going to talk about that coming up a little bit later as well.
Yes, sir.
So for about 6 years, you've been a police officer. You've been an investigator for how long?
About a year and a half, a little over a year and a half.
Okay. So the first question that comes to my mind would be, if you're going to give a detective's perspective on civilian gunfighting, what should civilians who carry guns, what should they be looking out for?
Well, number one, I would say that number one is looking out for is their protection, is their safety. That's why they're carrying a gun. So I'm a huge believer in concealed carry, and I think most of my colleagues are big proponents of concealed carry by civilians, as long as it's being done legally and in accordance with the law. But first and foremost, they need to worry about their own safety, making sure that they're responsible, prepared to be able to, number one, use that weapon appropriately, and number two, be able to do it without, you know, in the right time, without hesitating.
Okay, you just said something interesting. And by the way, I want to let listeners know, you're from Lubbock, Texas.
Yes, sir.
So, you know, good to have somebody from West Texas on the show.
Thank you.
What you just said is use it appropriately. Use their gun appropriately. Now, in your career as a homicide investigator, what kind of mistakes do you see that citizens have made out there that carry guns? Let's talk about the mistakes first.
Easy enough. And it's common sense, Bob. First off is most people that that get into wanting to carry a gun for personal protection who do it legally via the CHL, they have common sense. They know where to carry it, where not to carry it, and when. And one of the things, you know, to use it as an example is, again, common sense. Don't carry it if you're going to be out drinking. If you're going to be, or have no, or a limited ability to be able to think rationally, think clearly, you know, that even prescription medication, and guns just don't mix.
Right.
If there's ever a time where you're going to go out and want to have a good time, that's great. Have a good time, but leave the gun safely at home or with somebody responsible that can take care of it for you until you're ready to go again.
I bet you've investigated cases where people didn't obey that advice.
Absolutely. One of the most recent ones, we had a homicide. It ended up being a gunfight between two individuals at a bar. So. Absolutely. Both of them were intoxicated and not in their right mind.
Yep. I bet you both of them are paying some pretty stiff penalties.
One paid the ultimate price, and the other one is facing some legal difficulties here in the not-too-distant future.
Doesn't surprise me. Now, I'm begging to ask you this question. I think I know the answer, but I'm begging to hear what you say, or I'm anxious to hear your response. When you show up at a crime scene, do you show up right after the shooting has taken place?
No, that's usually patrol. Patrol, you know, the uniform guys in the marked patrol units are going to be the ones that show up just because a 911 calls the dispatch. So they'll show up, and then from there, they'll do an initial investigation, secure the scene, hold on to any witnesses that may be at the scene, and then they will go ahead and do what they call a homicide call-out. At least for my department, it's a homicide call-out, and they'll go ahead and call the homicide supervisor and the number of detectives that they need. And it's at that point, a little while after, that we get out to the scene and we pick up the investigation from there.
Okay, so you're investigating it, and by the time you investigate it, you know things like what kind of weapon was used and some basics of what transpired.
Sometimes there's times where we don't know the weapon until you know, unfortunately, an autopsy is done, or if the person is not killed, they remove the slug from the victim at the hospital. And even then, if they're so, you know, slugs can be completely mangled to where they're not identifiable. Other times, absolutely, we know what's out there. We know, you know, because of shell casings, what calibers were used, approximately how many rounds were fired based on where those casings landed and where the bullet holes are.
Okay, you partially answered the question I was dying to ask, and that is, does it really matter what caliber that people use?
No, from what I've seen even before being a police officer, it really doesn't, as far as handgun rounds. I've seen people hit and survive 22 rounds, but I've also seen people hit one time and killed with a 22 round. I've seen people hit with 45s and 40s and lived and survived just fine.
Yeah. So, and that's pretty much the what we hear out there. You know, we hear that with today's good ammunition, there's not much of a difference if a civilian is going to defend themselves. If they know how to use the gun, they can use it properly, and they're properly trained, it doesn't make much of a difference, does it?
Absolutely. And we've heard it several times before. You buy the equipment and the ammunition that you can afford. You buy the best that you can afford, and then you train with what you have.
Okay. So, what
What's the process that someone can expect to go through, even if they legitimately use their handgun in a legitimate self-defense case? What can they expect to go through?
Well, you know, the overarching thing is there's going to be an investigation. But from, if you don't mind, let me step it this way. First off, right away, I'm a police officer, of course. I'm not an attorney, and I always recommend everybody have an attorney on speed dial. Have an attorney ready to go before any of these types of scenarios take place. But in the case that it does take place, number one, don't panic. If you're in the right, you're in the right. But your first phone call should be to the police. Call dispatch. You know, you don't have to give a whole lot of information, but basically let them know that there was a shooting, that you were defending yourself, and that you're the victim. And they're going to dispatch officers out there.
You mean 911, correct?
911, yes, sir. When officers get out to the scene, you know, there's a number of things that can happen. You know, anywhere from separating you, maybe putting you in the back of a police car, to if they have to, you know, depending on, you know, they're gonna show up with the mindset of them protecting themselves first. You may be ordered to lay on the ground to extend your arms and your legs, and then you may be handcuffed. It sounds scary, but it's not that big of a deal once you understand it, and just know that's just part of the process, or could be part of the process. Number two, they're more than likely going to confiscate your weapon because it is, in fact, evidence, but that weapon will be returned to you after the disposition of the case.
Really?
Yes. Even with me, I was involved in a shooting a number of years ago when I was fairly new to the police department. And even with me, they took my weapon. So I was investigated just like anybody else. Not necessarily me investigated, but the incident was investigated.
But the weapon was returned to you.
It was returned to me, yes, sir.
Because I read a lot of stuff, you know, and of course, most of us know that not everything you read on the internet is true, but you read a lot of stuff, or I read a lot of things that say, you know, if you use your gun in self-defense, you can just kiss that gun goodbye. You'll never see it again.
You know, that could be the case. I mean, evidence is evidence, and but we're talking about a justifiable shooting here, with everything turning out to be good. You may lose that gun for a period of time. You know, it could be a number of years, a couple years or whatever. Just you know, as long as it takes for it to go to trial, if it was to even go that far. But once the disposition of the case is released, then that gun is no longer evidence and can be released back to its owner.
Okay.
Just to illustrate that, I had a case where an individual was arrested. I won't go into the details of the case, but long story short, he was arrested. The officers took his gun. I ended up going to grand jury as a witness, or as to testify as the investigator on that case. And based on the investigation, there was not enough evidence to support the allegation for which he was arrested. His firearm was immediately, as soon as they had this position and I was able to get a hold of him, his gun was released back to him without any further incident at all.
Wow. Well, I mean, that's good.
Absolutely. You know, there may be reasons for this belief or not, but the police are actually, I don't want to say they're necessarily on anybody's side, but they're on the side of doing the right thing. For the most part, there's their bad apples, of course, you know, and then in any profession. But for the most part, in my experience, we're there for justice, whether for the shooter or the shootee, if you will.
Okay, good. Jess, another question. Does a police officer have a duty to protect somebody?
Yes, they do.
They do have a duty?
Yes, sir.
I've heard it both ways. I've heard it said that they do not have a duty, that they should do it, but it's not an obligation, and I've heard that they do.
Sure.
Okay. Well, so
in my mind, they have a duty to protect you know, a third party. If they're there and they're able to act, then yes, in my mind, they do have a duty. And I, you know, it may just be based on jurisdiction, but in my mind, yes.
Okay. Good. Good. Now, without mentioning specifics. Because I know you don't want to get anybody in trouble. How long does it typically get, at least in the jurisdictions you work in, how long does it typically take for the police to show up on the scene after 911's been called?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. It's something that I want to really foot stomp. It can take anywhere from seconds to minutes, depending on where officers are at and just how busy they are. We'll say on a Monday night, if you need officers right away, they could be there. I mean, it's, you know, at least in my area, it's generally a kind of a slower night. However, on a Saturday night, you may wait a few minutes. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but the bottom line here is you can't rely on the police necessarily to be right there when you need them. It's kind of like your catchphrase, you carry a gun because you can't carry a cop with you.
Exactly. Well, and that's where I was going with this because I'm hoping that there's somebody who is either anti-gun or somewhat a little bit against guns. I hope they're listening to this. And I hope that they understand that it's their duty and their duty only to be the first responder to something that's happening to them.
Absolutely. I'm a huge believer in the civilian operator or that civilian warrior, concealed carry person. That is the true first responder because they're right there when something happens. If we're talking about a mall shooting, it's those individuals with their concealed carry pistol with the willingness and the training to be able to do something that can save lives. Why wait for a responding officer that could take up to minutes to be able to act now and save lives?
Okay. As an investigator, have you seen an increase or a decline or kind of a flat level amount of self-defense incidents?
In where I work in Lubbock, we really don't see a whole lot. Generally, the homicides that I've been involved with so far have been felonious in nature. They've been bad guy killing a victim.
Right.
I have seen a number of officer-involved shootings, which, you know, in my mind are self-defense shootings, namely an individual running at officers with a knife. I mean, just beelined it for the officer, and they were forced to shoot him.
Okay. Well, these cases where a bad guy shoots a victim, mm-hmm. is the victim a good guy, or are they a felon, too?
Unfortunately, the ones that I've been involved with, they are felons. However, there are a few that I was able to help on where the victim was a true victim in their own home, and they were ambushed and killed by somebody that they had no idea who they were. Of course, you know, not giving details, we had an individual here, I guess about a year ago or a little bit more, in his own home. Individual was in his yard, and like anybody, he was inside his home. He tapped on his window to ask this individual what he was doing in his yard. And without any warning, that guy forced his way in and fired a number of rounds, hitting him a number of times, and eventually killing him in his own home.
Yep. Well, and that goes without explaining why you need to have protection inside your own home.
Absolutely.
Didn't you say you have investigated or you've had situations where someone was charging a police officer with a knife?
Yes.
They were making a beeline for the cop with a knife?
Yes, sir.
And the cop had to shoot the guy coming at him with a knife.
Yes, sir.
But wait a minute, Jess. People have said over and over and over again that you should never bring a knife to a gunfight, that guns are always superior to knives, so why would a cop have to shoot the guy?
Well, I think that's based on some maybe some Hollywood depictions, maybe some Hollywood martial art types presentations, but knives are ugly. You very rarely see a knife. I've interviewed so many people that say that, well, I got stabbed, but at the time I didn't know I was getting stabbed. I thought I was just being punched, when in fact they were stabbed a number of times and severely. For me, I don't play around with a knife. Knives are more are scarier to me than a gun, just because most of the time you can't see them coming unless the person wants you to see it, and they don't run out of bullets. They just keep on going and going and going until finally, you know, if you're able to stop them, or they stop you.
Yeah, and I said that was kind of a rhetorical question. I'm kind of in a roundabout way, I'm picking on people that have claimed to me over and over and over again that a gun is always superior to a knife. And, you know, I've tried to rebut that by saying, yeah, well, maybe at a distance, of course, sure. At a distance of 10, 15, 20 yards, yeah. But at close range, probably, what would you say, inside of 10 or 15 feet?
Absolutely.
Inside of 10 or 15?
Even further, you know, it's all fight focused. It's all dependent on the scenario.
Yeah. So inside of a range of 10, 15, 20, 21 feet, boy, someone who gets a jump on you with a knife, you know, don't rely on your gun as that magical binky that's going to save everything.
Absolutely.
But yet, so these police officers had to shoot, and I hope that these police officers were successful in shooting.
Yes, they were.
Yeah, because if they were not, they would have got cut badly, possibly killed.
Oh, badly. Absolutely.
You know, when you're in your investigations, what's the primary top three things you're looking for?
As far as what?
Are you trying to solve it? Are you just trying to look for key pieces of evidence? Are you trying to look for both at the same time? Are you trying to figure out who got shot with what and who fired the first shot? Stuff like that?
Absolutely. It's all inclusive. We're trying to look for all of that. We're trying to, our main goal is to piece together what happened to the best of our ability. And we do that in a number of ways. We do that by collecting evidence. We have, at least here in my department, we have a crime scene unit that actually comes out to the scene. They're the primary guys that are responsible for processing the scene for evidence. While they're doing that, we have a number of investigators interviewing victims, witnesses, suspects, gathering all the information that they can from the individuals that were involved or witnessed it. And then we piece all that together to the best of our ability. And you know, if you're not there, if you're not the fly on the wall, you really don't have a complete picture of what happened. But we do the best we can to put together the facts of the case based on evidence and information to be able to explain what happened. And then we take that information, we present it to the district attorney's office, who in turn will present it to a grand jury of 12 individuals.
Okay, now Jess, let me ask you right about there. You're trying to gather the facts of the case. If I, being a law-abiding citizen, if I have to use my firearm to defend my life, when can I expect to meet you, the private investigator?
You're going to meet me fairly soon, right after. At the beginning on that question where we talked about who's responding and when the detectives get there. Patrol officers get there first, and then from there they do their homicide call out, and then anywhere from within a half hour to an hour, you could be talking to a detective.
Yeah, sorry, I misspoke. I said the word private investigator. I know you're not a private investigator. I know you're a detective. So I'm going to meet you pretty quickly.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And would you advise people when they come to meet you that they have excellent legal representation?
I would. The first phone call is always to the police. Your second phone call, or as soon as you possibly can, is to your attorney. I advise people to work with the police, cooperate with the police. At the very beginning, when you're talking to officers and whatnot, be limited in the information you give, but be respectful. Don't be belligerent, comply with those lawful orders from the police officers. But at the earliest convenience, call your attorney, have your legal representation, and have them there as soon as you possibly can. And I would advise them not to give any statement, official statement, and without your attorney being present. That way, you know, number one, it's not necessarily that you're trying to hide anything, but you want your attorney there so that they can be aware and know what you have said and advise you as to what to expect in the process. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense, and I want to take a little bit of time here to put in a quick plug for all my fellow Texans and some of the surrounding states. This is where services like Texas Law Shield really come into play. If you're outside of Texas, the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network, you know, networks like this where you can get instant representation by a lawyer, you can call an 800 number, things like that, and you can be represented quickly. What you're saying, Jess, is that's very important.
Absolutely, and have it done long before a situation like this arises. As soon as you make that decision to carry concealed and to be responsible for your own safety, as you should, have your legal representation ready to go at a moment's notice. There shouldn't have to be going through the phone book, trying to scramble and find somebody after this has already happened.
After it's happened, you don't want to be scrolling through a phone book or on the internet trying to find it. You're not going to be in the right frame of mind to be doing that.
No, it's already stressful enough, and that's the time where you need to start decompressing, and you need somebody there by your side that is objective and basically has your interests at heart.
Right. And by the way, Texas Law Shield is still, if listeners want to use my coupon code, you still get 2 free months with the price of 12, with the price of a year membership, and just use HGWorld1 as the coupon code, and I'll put that in the show notes. Jess, I wanted to ask you something else.
Yes, sir.
When you get the person and you're investigating, you're the detective, you're asking questions, do you find that the people typically remember more, a whole lot more about the incident than they were able to tell the officers that initially arrived?
I think it depends on the person. If you don't mind, I'll speak from personal experience with my incident.
Sure.
I remember it more the longer time passed after the incident.
And why is that?
That's a great question. I don't know. I don't know. I recall being able to see snapshots of basically what had happened, but it wasn't until a few days later that I was able to start piecing the a complete picture of what had happened afterwards. I think it's just dependent on the person. I wish I knew more about that. I think that's more along the psychology of these types of incidents.
Sure,
but it may take some time.
Do you think that, I think it's because people's mental clarity, once they relax, I think their mental clarity gets better because they're not quite as shooken up and they've got their lawyer now and they've had time, like you said earlier, to decompress.
Absolutely. Things happen. I mean, these things, talking about a reactive gunfight here, not a proactive gunfight that I know you've touched on thoroughly in your show, but a reactive gunfight happens so fast. It's basically you fall to your highest level of training.
Yeah, I would submit that sometimes we even fall short of our highest level of training because we are so freaked out by the encounter itself. You know, for most civilians, this is not something that we go through every day.
Absolutely.
And because we don't go through it every day, we're not used to having to whip out a gun and protect ourselves each and every single day. I think even people who are used to it, they're still traumatized by it.
Absolutely. It's just, even at least in my jurisdiction, we as police officers, we do pull our guns several times throughout a career, several times, in a week. But very rarely are we forced into a situation where we have to pull that trigger. And even for the law officers that carry all the time and are used to having that gun on their hip, it can be a stressful time.
Yeah, it can. You've been a detective how long?
A little over a year and a half.
Okay. So how are you enjoying it?
I enjoy it. It's a learning experience. But it's been very rewarding. It's different to say the least. That's probably the best word for it.
So as a detective, what other pieces of advice would you give civilian carriers of firearms?
Probably the most basic, the most common sense, do what is right and let the consequence follow. Saying that my mom always told me, which is basically be in the right place at the right time, doing what's right, doing things that you should be doing. Do it in good faith, and when I say good faith, have confidence that you're doing the right thing.
Okay.
Let it work itself out, because it will. The system is not perfect, but it will work itself out.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Doing the right thing. I think, first of all, carrying a gun, we're doing the right thing.
Absolutely.
Because we're taking our responsibility for our self-defense in our own hands, and we're not relying on somebody else to do it.
Absolutely.
Because even, I asked you the question earlier, how long does it typically take for police to respond? Even if they can get there within 60 seconds, the whole thing can be over long before 60 seconds.
Absolutely.
And you and I probably both know the reality is probably somewhere between a couple of minutes to as many as 15 minutes.
Exactly. It all just depends on the situation in the city, which, you know, you're not going to know. You've got to have that responsibility. You've got to take responsibility for your own safety and your family's safety, and not rely on somebody else to do that for you.
Yeah. So what's been the most rewarding part of being a detective?
Well, there's a few. What I do like is when there's false allegations made against an individual, and you're able to eventually get to the so-called victim and get them to admit that, okay, yeah, they made this up. For whatever reason, they made it up, and you're able to help that so-called suspect feel vindicated.
Well, you know what? That just sparked another question in my mind. Do you normally find out that there are eyewitnesses that have seen part of the event?
Oh, absolutely. There are eyewitnesses. Now, whether or not they're going to come forward and cooperate is a whole other story. But, yeah, there are many times eyewitnesses to events.
So people, if they're doing the right thing, or they want to, you know, they want to make sure that they're doing the right thing because there could be people watching.
Absolutely. And though there's always a camera. There is always a camera.
Everywhere. There's a camera everywhere.
On your cheapest throwaway phone, there's a camera.
Yeah. I used to be in the surveillance camera business. And this, you know, I left that business about 4 years ago, but we used to talk about that the average American is on camera over 2,000 times per year.
Wow.
Yeah, think about that. Over 2,000 times a year, you're being captured on video. Now, I think that's a huge, huge invasion of privacy, but it's the world we live in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. At least for, you know, police officers, we're always being recorded. And that's okay. But at the same time, if you're involved in an incident and there are witnesses that are recording it, that's okay too. It doesn't mean that the good guy doing the shooting has done anything wrong. You know, that video could actually and more than likely will help investigators like myself put it together and realize, okay, this is a good shoot.
Yeah. Well, sometimes, you're right. The video that's taken of the event can often work in your favor.
Absolutely. And then you, of course, combine that with the evidence at the scene, as well as, statements from witnesses and other involved parties, if you will.
But hearing you talk in the last 30 minutes or so, it sounds like that if someone's going to carry a firearm, they really need to get some very good training or instruction on how to do the right thing.
Absolutely.
And when to do the right thing and when not to do the wrong thing, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. For me, it's a comfort thing, or a peace of mind thing. Get the training, get good training, and make sure it's applicable to real world, and do your best, to train as much as you can. And just, you know, let things happen as they're going to happen. But I think there's a peace of mind when, we prepare ourselves as best as we possibly can, especially when it comes to defending ourselves and our loved ones.
Do you ever feel this, Jess? Do you ever feel that maybe there are citizens out there carrying guns around that they might legitimately be attacked and they're legitimately acting in self-defense, what some people would call a good shoot, but because they didn't have very good training, that they made some pretty bad tactical mistakes that come back to haunt them later?
I haven't seen it. I mean,
no?
Granted, I have a year and a half of experience. But as a police officer, no, I generally see if somebody is acting in good faith, doing what they believe to be the right thing at the right time for the right reasons, they're going to be okay.
They're going to be okay. Okay, good.
It's not set in stone, but they're going to be okay. I mean, we all make mistakes. I don't care how good anybody is, you're going to make mistakes. There's always that golden BB out there, golden BB. And Murphy always tends to be around these situations when they happen.
You hate that Murphy guy, don't you?
Absolutely.
I hate that Murphy guy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Murphy really ticks me off sometimes. But, you know, he has a habit of hanging around a lot.
He does. He does. I mean, we can have the best plan, and it can go out the window because the bad guy didn't necessarily comply with the plan that we had in our head.
Gee, isn't that interesting? I bet you find that a lot as a detective, is that the bad guy doesn't always comply with what the good guy wanted.
Absolutely. And for the life of me, I don't know why why they do that sometimes. But, you know, again, it is what it is.
Well, because they're a
they're called bad guys for a reason.
Well, I was going to say, they're a professional bad guy. What do you expect?
Exactly.
You know, if they were capable of choosing a different profession, they probably would.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks for the info here. I think hopefully I asked some questions that some of the listeners were thinking about. Now, let's talk about, you've also got a class. One of the cool things is you're hosting in Lubbock, you're hosting my good friend John Payne, who's going to go up there and teach close-range gunfighting.
Yes, sir. We sure are, April 12th and 13th.
April 12th and 13th, the week after my CRG2 class that I'm teaching here in San Antonio.
Yes, sir.
And you've got quite a few people. I have quite a few signed up. You got quite a few signed up there in Lubbock as well. So this is a call out to everybody from West Texas or in the general vicinity. Get over to CRG2 in Lubbock. What are you excited about for that class?
Everything. It is your reality base. I know that, you know, it's kind of a hot word in the community today, but it really is. It's reality. Being able to shoot and move and get accurate hits as you're moving, and avoiding getting hit at all costs. I don't even know where to start. What's the best thing that I'm looking forward to? Basically, all of it. It's reality based. It's real, and it's. It's something that, in my mind, is going to be the students going to be able to apply it out the door. As soon as they leave that course, they're going to have skills in their toolbox that they can apply right then and there.
Hey, speaking of hits, let's go back to when you were an officer, because you were an officer that arrived on the scene first, right after a shooting, right?
I'm trying to think. Yes.
You've done that?
I have.
What type of hits, where did you typically see the bad guys hit that made them stop what they were doing?
Yeah, that depended on the person. I've seen grazing wounds that stopped the person right there. They weren't anything severe or deep or anything like that, but it stopped them. I've seen very severe wounds up in the torso, and the bad guy walked 50 yards. Before finally succumbing to his wounds. I mean, there's no, there's no grand bullet that's going to have the ultimate answer in stopping.
Really? So you mean like a super hot plus P loaded 40 caliber round is not the ultimate man stopper, huh?
No.
Again, a little bit of sarcasm I'm throwing in there, but you get the point. The gearheads out there are more worried about their gear than they are about how well they can shoot their gun.
Absolutely. Now, that goes back to the fact you still want to buy good quality gear, good quality ammo.
Right.
Train with it. But there's so many factors in these types of situations. They're dynamic. They happen suddenly, you know, and who knows what type of adversary you're going to be coming up against. They may be somebody who is just depressed and wants to die, and they may just do that easily, or it may be somebody who is drugged out of their mind, and they just are having a hard time feeling anything, but their body will keep on going and keep on going until it finally just receives enough hits to stop.
Basically, any hit on the bad guy is bad for him and good for you.
Absolutely, and the more the better.
Exactly. Oh, there you go. The more, the better. Hence the need. Well, but wait a minute, Jess. There are people in the government that say that all you need is 5 shots from a revolver.
Well, that's fine. You know, they're the government, and I'm not going to they're the government. The politicians, they have their bodyguards. But it'd be interesting to get their perspective when they're involved in a gunfight.
Exactly. When they're involved in a gunfight and their lack of knowledge is tested.
Exactly.
Because after all, you don't need an AR-15 with 30-round mags. All you need is a double-barrel shotgun.
Well,
that's all you need.
Exactly.
I mean, hey.
According to some, but I'm going to err on the side of caution and have more BBs in my gun.
well, you know, those people that are paid higher than you and I that are supposedly the all-knowing, there's no reason on earth why anybody needs to have 30 rounds in a magazine, according to them.
Well, there again, well, shoot, I'd invite them to the CRG2, Close Range Gunfighting, and maybe some Force on Force, and, you know, it could be a very interesting discussion.
Now, Force on Force, I'm glad you brought that up. When you go to a Force on Force class, preferably one that Suarez International teaches, that's when you realize how good of a shooter you're not.
Absolutely. That's an eye-opener.
Well, it's also an ego buster. I want to warn anybody that goes to force on force or 0 to 5 feet pistol gunfighting, which is basically a force on force class that I've taken. You know, man, leave your ego, preferably at home or at least in your car in the parking lot, because it will mess you up and you will learn, like I said, you'll learn how good you're not.
Absolutely. When you start taking shots to the head and, stand and deliver, fast draw didn't work for you, it opens your eyes. But at the same time, when you leave that ego behind and learn to go ahead and bust off the X, you learn that you too can put rounds on target while moving dynamically, and I think it raises your confidence more than your little ego would.
Well, and CRG, Close Range Gunfighting, Level 1 and 2, pretty much those are the – that's laying the foundation. That's laying the foundation for anything that a civilian carrier is going to want to know later on. And really, I mean, an encounter with a bad guy is probably – and maybe you could give me a different perspective as a detective, but I'm assuming an encounter with a bad guy is pretty much going to be like a force-on-force event.
Absolutely. They're close. They're close. They're fast. You know, out of all of my call-outs, there's only been one that happened in broad daylight, and that was a domestic where it was a husband and a wife. But shootings happen, more likely low-light, reactionary, close-range. You're going to be just within feet of each other. And, you know, it's more likely going to be multiple bad guys.
And you just said something interesting, and folks, I want people to know I did not set Jess up for that answer that he just gave. But last week's podcast was about low light and night fighting. And last week I had John Hottaway on, and we talked about the importance of training in low light and taking a night class. And yes, there are ranges that do it, and there are instructors that teach it. And like you just said, you basically said what most people have talked about, that these events typically happen in low light or at night.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's a whole different ballgame. It is a different world when you have to hold a flashlight in one hand and shoot your pistol and be accurate in the other hand and move at the same time. And even if you have a weapons-mounted light, that takes a degree of manipulation to be good with. And you need to know what you're doing with that as well.
Absolutely. Again, it goes back to training. And I for one, will say that's going to be a weak area for me. I don't train at night nearly enough. And it's something that I'm going to get better at here over the next few months.
And a lot of people don't even – they have night sights on their gun, but they don't know how their night sights are going to perform in a shooting. I mean, it's easy to go into your closet, turn all the lights off, and look at your night sights and go, oh, wow, look at that. They're glowing. All three of them giving me big, nice, big glowing dots. That's all fine and dandy. But when you're under stress and you got a flashlight in your left hand and a gun in your right hand and you're trying to move because someone could be firing at you, you know, all of a sudden those big glowing night sights aren't as glowing and as big as they looked inside your closet.
Absolutely not. At least in my experience, I don't remember seeing my night sights at all.
Talk about that.
It was back in 2009. I got a call to a burglary in progress, and the description of the house that was being burglarized was clear, but the actual location, the address, was not. And so by the time I got on scene, bad guys were still there. Well, they ended up seeing me around the corner, and then I was able to get eyes on the house and realize, okay, well, this is the house, and oh, hey, those are the bad guys running out of the house, and hey, they got property in their trunk. And so I stopped the cars, you know, as best I could, got out, threw my lights on, and drew my pistol. And from the time that I threw on my lights to the time that I had shots fired was 7 seconds. Distance, I'm not quite sure on what the distance was, but it wasn't much. But basically, long story short, they got in the car, refused to obey commands to stop their car, and they drove it right at me and continued driving it at me. Even as I was doing my best to get off the X, they were still steering it towards me. And,
You fired.
I fired.
Now, you said it was 7 seconds between the time that you got your light out. You mean like a handheld light?
Oh, I'm sorry. My overhead police lights, my emergency light.
Oh, your overhead police. Okay.
I stepped out of the car as I threw my lights on, threw my pistol, and they're charging me with the car.
And it was 7 seconds between that time and when you fired?
About. Probably a little bit less.
And you don't remember seeing your night sights?
No. It was all too fast, too close. Now 7 seconds, you know, some may say, well, that's a long time. Well, you know, 7 seconds, yeah, it is a long time, but the actual engagement lasted, milliseconds. I mean, it was so fast. Even in their car, you know, it's surprising how fast a car can accelerate when somebody's stomping on the gas.
Well, that's interesting. Because it's interesting you say that you don't remember your night sights, because some people think that once they put night sights on their pistol, all of a sudden that makes them Wyatt Earp at night.
Well, I'd like to meet them then.
The thing is you don't remember seeing them, see? And that's what happens when we get under stress. We don't remember hearing, and we don't remember seeing, and sometimes we don't even remember how many shots we fired.
Nope. And it's all based on the individual. I knew exactly how many shots I fired. I knew that I fired because I could hear them, but they weren't very loud. But beyond that, not really. But let me say this real quick, Bob, if I can.
Yeah.
In 2007, I attended a Force on Force. It was my first SI course. Force on Force, Gabe Suarez is the one who taught it in Amarillo, Texas. I heard about Suarez International, you know, before, but they were never here. Finally, they were here, so I jumped on it and got in that class. And I will attribute me not being hit by that car or being hurt in any way in that incident because of what I learned at Force on Force. Now, this is not a plug. I don't teach Force on Force or anything like that, of course. But it was getting off the X that I believe saved my tail and not necessarily the gun in my hand at that moment.
Aha! Getting off the X. For people who have not had such training, they've heard me talk about it, but let's hear you talk about it. What is get off the X?
Get off the X is get off the line of attack. Get off the spot that person is directing their force or their action or their violence towards. Get out of the way.
Well, you got to have some way to move. You have to be able to think. And you have to practice some of this stuff. And, you know, you have to practice how you're going to get off the X.
Absolutely.
And you have to practice it in multiple directions. You got to practice it laterally. You got to practice it diagonally. You know, you got to practice. And you have to be able to not only get off the X, but also defend yourself. Because, like you said, those people with the car, those bad guys with the car, the more you moved, they're still chasing you, weren't they?
Absolutely. I talked earlier about snapshots. One of the snapshots that is burned in my memory forever will be looking at the driver and actually seeing his hands steering that wheel towards me. Why I remember that, you know, why is that burned in my memory, I don't know. But it was a very vivid, in my mind on what I saw at that moment. And there was no doubt in my mind that they were steering that car to me.
Now, do you mind talking about how it ended? I mean, you're still here talking to us, so that's a good thing, but can you talk about how it ended?
Well, I won't get into too much detail, but I will say that one round was caught by the my first round was caught by the driver's side airbag. The other round impacted the bad guy.
Good.
And then, you know, of course, there's two of them. They're doing time now. They're both incarcerated right now.
Did you have to shoot through glass?
I did. Shot through a vent window as well as a driver's side window.
Can you talk about what caliber it was?
It was a 40 caliber Smith and I'm sorry, a 6 hour 229 DAK trigger with Golden Saber rounds, 40 caliber.
Okay. And the Golden Saber rounds penetrated the glass.
Absolutely.
Okay. Good. You know, talking to people like you that have had these real life experiences. You know, you've been in a gunfight, you defended your life with a handgun, and you attribute it to good training.
Absolutely. You know, there again, it didn't go as planned in my mind as it probably should, but there again, at the same time, I expected them to give up as soon as they saw the police, and that's just not the way it works.
But what you learned in Force on Force helped you.
Absolutely.
Good. Well, folks, you know, CRG 2, I think this is the first time it's ever been taught in the Lubbock area.
As far as I know, yes, sir.
Yeah, and, you know, people have heard John Payne on this show before, and they've heard me say some good things about his ability to teach. And for those of you that are in Central and South Texas, I've taught this course before and had a lot of really good feedback, so you're going to get excellent instruction from me also. But, you know, if you're in West Texas, get to this course up there in Lubbock. It's April 12th and 13th. Did I get that right?
Yes, sir.
Tell people what range it's at.
It's going to be at 41 Lead Farm. It's a new range just south of town. Anybody from the Lubbock area that knows Tom Larson, he owns Empire Pond here in Lubbock. He owns that range. Just recently opened it. It's about 10 miles south of town on Highway 41.
Good. Good. Well, you know, there might be a lot of people who didn't even know that that class was coming to West Texas. So just go over to Suarez International. By the way, in the show notes for this episode, I will put a direct link that will send them straight to the SI website where they can sign up for the Lubbock class.
Perfect. And they're going to want to do it soon. I haven't talked to John a whole lot the last couple of days. I'm not sure on where the enrollments are, but from our last conversation, there's only a few left. So I encourage everybody to get on there and get enrolled as soon as you possibly can. It'll be an investment into your own life.
Well, I am logging into the instructor portion of the SI website right now, and I'm not going to give out the exact number, but I'll take a quick look here as to how many people are signed up for that class in Lubbock. Give me that date again, April 12th and 9th. Yeah, it's the day. It's the week after mine.
Yes, sir, April 12th and 13th.
I'm just going to say, folks, there are a significant number of people signed up. Don't procrastinate, because John has a limit. I mean, he wants to make sure that there's a good class experience for everybody.
Absolutely.
Enrollments are pretty healthy. I'll just leave it at that.
Fantastic.
Well, Jess, thanks a lot. And, you know, I'll give you the floor for the last couple minutes. Anything you want to tell people out there?
Again, I can't stress it enough. Just do what is right. Do the right thing at the right time in the right place, and be prepared for these types of situations, because you never know when they're going to happen. But if you're prepared, it gives a peace of mind to it before it even happens, and then of course during and after.
Yeah, I have an old saying that as civilians we don't go out looking for trouble, but sometimes trouble finds us.
Absolutely. And if it does find you, be the one that can stop it.
Yeah, absolutely. Jess, thanks very much for your time. This was great.
Thank you, Bob. Anytime.
Thanks.
Well, many thanks to Jess. I appreciate all the people who come on this show and spend some time with me and talk about their expertise. I learned a lot from that. I hope you did too. Make sure if you're in West Texas that you head on over to that class, Close Range Gunfighting 2, which is a Suarez International class. John Payne is teaching that one, and it's just pretty much the same class that I am going to be teaching in San Antonio, April 5th and 6th. So if you're in South Texas, come on over to my Close Range Gunfighting 2 class in San Antonio, April 5 and 6. And if you're going to be up in Lubbock the following weekend, go over to Jess's the class that Jess is hosting. He's the host of that class. John Payne is going to be the instructor. Now, let me finish off the show by saying this. I got a lot of voicemails in my inbox. I do promise I will get to those. Last week, my wife and I didn't get such good news. Her ALS doctor said he's confirming the diagnosis, that that's what she has. You know, we're holding out hope. We're still holding out some hope, and it's kind of tough, though. So understand that it's a tough thing to deal with. I'm going to keep doing the podcast. This is kind of my release. It's kind of my escape. I'm going to keep training as much as I can. Being able to go out and do some classes might be limited for the rest of 2014 and 2015, and let's see what the future holds. Still a lot of uncertainties, but, you know, her ALS doctor was not real certain before. You know, we kind of got a lot of conflicting reports, let's put it that way, and we sought a second opinion, and we sought a third opinion, and those two doctors disagreed. But her most recent trip to the neurologist who has diagnosed her with ALS says, yeah, I'm sure that's what your issues are. Well, as you know, it's incurable and it's fatal, and there's, you know, there's really no known cause of it either. So I just, you know, I beg your understanding on that. It's a difficult time, very difficult for me and my family. But like I said, shooting, doing this podcast, getting out to the range, teaching a class, and all that, that's my release. Now, recently I started taking some Krav Maga classes, and that's got me all pumped up, too. I've been taking some gun takeaway classes. That's pretty neat. You know, it's amazing. I'm surprised how easy it is to take a gun away from somebody. So I'm going to show you some things that I've learned in that class coming up later on down the road. But I'll just say this, you know, if you take a class with me, either any of the Suarez International classes that I teach or any of the classes that Ben and I teach, if you take one of those, well, let's just put it this way. Keep that gun as close to your body as you can if you're going to use it in self-defense, because if anybody else is skilled or somewhat skilled or even practices just some basic techniques, if you got that gun out there at full extension and you're relatively close to them, that's probably not a very good idea. It's fairly easy to take that gun away and disarm that person. And even if they try to pull the trigger, a person who knows what they're doing can probably escape from being shot and most likely disarm the gun from you. So think about that. And Krav Maga is awesome. I'm enjoying it quite a bit. Primarily, folks, I decided to do it for exercise. Krav Maga means contact combat. It's the Israeli term. It's what the Israeli military used to teach their soldiers in hand-to-hand combat. It's just good, practical, useful, on-the-street stuff. I do it 2 or 3 days a week. And also, it is really good for conditioning. So, you know, I know it's going to help me in my shooting skills too, especially, you know, the classes that we teach, it's basically martial arts with a gun. That's really what it is. And a fight's going to be a fluid event. A fight's going to be a dynamic event. It's going to be reactionary. People are going to be moving. Both you and the bad guy most likely are going to be moving. If all you're doing is shooting cardboard targets, and that's all the training you have, or that's all the practice that you have, I got to say, the more I learn, the more I realize that's just not enough. Because, you know, the person that you're defending yourself against is not likely going to stand still. And, in fact, he might be with buddies, and they're all going to be moving. And, you know, you're in a situation where you had no choice but to use your gun. And, of course, that's the only time we should use our gun, is when there is no other choice. It's game on, and that's it. You know, you've exhausted all possibilities to save your hide, and now you have to do the very last thing that you ever wanted to do in your life, and that is to draw your gun and shoot in self-defense. All I'm saying is make sure you know what you're doing when you draw that gun. Get some professional instruction from somebody, because you know what? What are we taught? What's the most common thing that we're taught? We're taught to draw that gun and thrust it out there to full extension and then fire. Well, sometimes that's good. I'm not saying you don't ever want to do that. Sometimes that's good. Sometimes that's not good, like when the bad guy is very close to you. So you got to know some positions that are closer to your body to help to shield yourself from a gun grab. And I'll leave it at that. You'll hear more from me about that in the future. You come to the training classes, I'll explain to you what I'm talking about, and you'll be learning to do some shooting that way as well. Ben and I just put a new video up on the Shooters Club. Actually, there's 2 or 3 new videos up there. So for those of you who are members, check it out. I emailed you a new password. If you're not a member, consider joining the Shooters Club. As you know, we got a lot of good giveaways coming up on June 30th. One of them is a gun. I'm giving away several holsters, a bunch of ammo, and stuff like that. If you go to handgunworld.com, go to the Shooters Club page, you'll see a list of all the giveaways. The giveaway is going to be a random drawing. I'm going to use random.org, and it's going to be a completely random drawing. So all active members of our video club, our Shooters Club video, you're going to be able to participate in that. CRG 2. Now, April 5th and 6th, as I told you about my class, that thing is about two-thirds full. So many thanks to all of you who have been signing up. There's only so many students I can handle. I want to keep it a good learning experience for everybody. And I'm not going to divulge how many people are already signed up for the CRG 2 class out there in Lubbock that John Payne's teaching, that, and you just heard Jess, he's the host of it. I'm not going to divulge how many are signed up for that, but I can tell you that you don't want to procrastinate on that one either. And, you know, there's not very many of them in Texas being taught this year, period. Not very many close-range gunfighting 2 classes being taught. So check that out. And if you want to go, we've still got the discounted prices of only $350 for the 2 days. So head on over there and don't procrastinate. Okay, folks, that's about it. I'm almost at my buddy's house here, and I got to help him unload a whole bunch of stuff. So I'm Bob Main. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. Thanks for listening to another episode of your weekly Handgun World podcast. The loudest sound a shooter hears is a bang when he's expecting a click, or a click when he's expecting a bang. Shoot straight, shoot safe. Talk to you next week. Goodbye.
Send lawyers, guns, and money. This shit has hit the fan.